Annoyed by delivery pipelines, frustrated with the toil of configuring CI/CD tools, you need Atomist. Atomist gives you a software delivery machine that automates delivery and eliminates toil. Get the delivery experience you've always wanted. Get Atomist. It's how teams deliver software.
Late last year, Charles Humble, the chief editor of InfoQ, and I were discussing the upcoming guests on the podcast. We decided to try a bit of an experiment and take a break from the show's normal routine of interviewing guests. And instead, we chatted with each other about the trends that we saw in the previous year, 2017 in this case, and the upcoming year in 2018. Well, it's a year later. That particular podcast worked out pretty well, so well, in fact, that we decided to give it a shot for another year and talk a bit about the trend that we saw in 2018 that we see upcoming in 2019. Hello and welcome to the InfoQ podcast. My name is Wes Rice and I host the podcast. In addition to hosting the InfoQ podcast, I chair a set of software conferences called QCon.
These podcasts are glimpses into some of the conversations I have with speakers getting ready for the conferences at QCon.
And today my guest on the show is Charles Humble. Charles Humble, as I mentioned, is the chief editor of InfoQ. He's my peer on the written side of the house. He's been there for about 5 years now. Prior to InfoQ, he was the CTO of PRPI, a small remuneration startup in the UK. And as I mentioned on the show, last year we decided to take this kind of experiment and see how it works out, of talking a bit about the trends that we saw in the previous year and the trends that we saw coming up for the next year. So today on the podcast, we're discussing topics from 2018, including things like autonomous vehicles and what's happened throughout 2018, including the state of regulations in California today. We're going to discuss privacy and data security in the realm of GDPR and some of the fallout from misuses of AI that we've heard in the news lately. We'll then shift gears a bit and we'll talk about 2019 and we'll discuss things like quantum computing. We'll discuss AR, VR. We'll discuss edge computing, service meshes, a bit about Kubernetes and more. As always, thank you for joining us on the InfoQ podcast. We look forward to having you in another new year. Charles, we're back for another year.
Yes, absolute pleasure. I always enjoy doing this.
Let's level set for a minute before we get into the kind of meat of this. So for people that may not remember from last year or may not be familiar with your voices, they are with mine. Your role at C4Media, the parent of InfoQ and QCon, is chief editor. So presumably, like me, that means you need to keep your pulse on software, so to speak. So how do you go about doing things like that?
A lot of that is down to the sort of regular editors that we have. So InfoQ's content is all written by what we call practitioners, which is essentially people that are software engineers for their profession, and they write for us for fun. But then we have a group of those that write regularly. They're essentially our news team. There are about 50 of those. And those folks write for me usually on a weekly or a bi-weekly kind of cadence. And we get together quite regularly at QCons and also through other means, through Slack or whatever, and really just talk about what we're seeing from the various different perspectives. So that's one of the main methods that I have. Obviously, for me, as you mentioned, I was a CTO, so my background is all quite technical, but I haven't programmed professionally since I took this job, which is 5 years ago. So I'm very reliant on them to kind of help me keep my finger on the pulse. And then the other thing I do is I sit on at least a couple of the QCon PCs along with you. And again, those groups are another way of kind of helping to keep connected and understand what's going on. Try and go to quite a lot of dev meetups and conferences that aren't the ones that we run, just so I don't get sort of too myopic and just see the kind of QCon InfoQ view of the world. And obviously you and I talk regularly as well, and I think that helps too.
At QCon London this upcoming March, you're actually hosting the Architecture You've Always Wondered About track. What are some of the talks that you have in there so far?
I've got the BBC coming. I hope it's not quite confirmed yet, but I think they'll be coming to talk about iPlayer. So iPlayer is their catch-up service. It's a huge service here in the UK particularly. And a couple of years ago, we had them talking about their sort of microservices journey and moving to AWS. So I'm hoping to do a kind of follow-up where we look at the client story. So iPlayer obviously runs on all kinds of smart TVs and mobile phones and desktops, and goodness knows what else. A lot of that's written in JavaScript. And I found it a really fascinating story when I talked to them about it. So I'm hoping to get them to talk. We've got Airbnb coming, and Airbnb will be talking a little bit about their microservices journey and then how running microservices in practice has been like for them. So how that's worked out in kind of reality. John Graham Cunning from Cloudflare, and he's going to be talking about Cloudflare Workers, which is their JavaScript-based serverless execution environment. So they have a cloud network of 155 data centers, I believe it is, and this is their kind of serverless offering that you can run on top of that. Couple of others which aren't confirmed yet, so I can't quite talk about those yet, but it's shaping up well. I'd like to get one more UK kind of London company in there, and then maybe another Bay Area Silicon Valley type to kind of round it out, but that's the general plan.
Makes sense. So I thought we'd kick off the show with just kind of looking back at 2018 and some of the things that stood out for you, stood out for me. I'll kick it off and start. One of the things that really stood out for me, just the pervasiveness of AI and how it's affecting our lives and how it will be affecting our lives in the near future. One of the first things that jumps to my mind is the autonomous driving cars, things that have happened. Mm-hmm. Can't mention autonomous driving cars without mentioning kind of the accident that happened in March of last year, I believe was what it was, the Uber accident.
It was around March, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Pulled Uber off the road, I believe, for 3 or 4 months while they kind of looked at different things. And I believe there's still information going on about it. But it definitely shows that there's lots of room for improvement here. But by the same token, I think in 2016, 2017, there's something like 34,000, 37,000 deaths, something like that, in North America alone from accidents. So I think that self-driving cars has just a tremendous ability to make a huge impact on just our daily lives.
Yes, I agree. I mean, partly for that reason, the vast majority of accidents that happen, not 100%, but the huge majority is down to driver error of one kind or another, whether that's misinterpreting or being distracted because you're fiddling with your radio or whatever it is. And eliminating that whole percentage of accidents or that whole reason for accidents, I think, is a good thing. I think ubiquitous autonomous vehicles are probably further away than a lot of people imagine. But I do think that autonomy within certain constraints, whether that's in certain types of city areas or, you know, certain locales or whatever it is still a big deal. And I think it's one of those things where there's still a way to go, but already I think there's the potential for these sorts of vehicles to save lives. And that's clearly a good thing. And it's also worth saying that you know, for people that are in places where mobility is a problem, in the UK, in rural areas, the sort of public transport network isn't all that it might be. And again, yes, sometimes there are taxi services, but not always. Autonomous vehicles for people that can't drive for one reason or another, maybe their eyesight isn't good enough or they're physically unable to drive. I do think that there's a technology that has huge, huge potential. And there will be accidents. There will inevitably be accidents, but that shouldn't blind us to the fact, as you said, that, you know, cars are pretty lethal. They're pretty big killers anyway. And autonomous vehicles have the possibility to improve that situation in a really major way.
Yeah, in most cases, these fully autonomous vehicles kind of catch the major headlines. But I think it's really important to note that in many cases, it's going to be augmenting people, at least in the short term or the near term. It's about, you know, the human in the AI loop, so to speak, is providing feedback and providing augmented information to people so that humans can make better decisions that maybe behind a car or other particular things.
Right. Yes.
Back onto that fully autonomous vehicle. I guess one important thing to note is that Waymo is now the first car in California that's allowed to be on the road fully autonomous. I don't know whether they've made any runs just yet, but October 30th of 2018, California passed a regulation that allowed fully autonomous vehicles in the Silicon Valley kind of area to be able to take the road. So I think that's definitely worthy of note.
So yeah, so Waymo have done, I believe it's 10 million autonomous miles and a further 7 billion simulated miles since 2009. And I think from talking to one or two people that you and I know who are in the industry who are working on this, they seem to be a long, long way ahead in terms of the amount of actual driving they've done. But then there are something like 60 other manufacturers that are approved to test autonomous vehicles with safety drivers in California, which is just astonishing, isn't it? So there's a lot of money and effort going into this. And obviously, we're just talking about cars here, but you've got trucks and you've got drones and all kinds of categories of autonomous vehicles of one kind or another that we're seeing work done on. It's a very, very interesting space.
It goes back again, 37,000 deaths in just North America alone. I'm not even counting the rest of the world, just in North America alone, 37,000 deaths. So there's a huge potential that either augmented decision-making or fully self-driving vehicles can save a lot of lives. There's another thing that I think was important in kind of the news that's more in your area of the world, and that's kind of GDPR, maybe some of the privacy inclinations. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So GDPR is the General Data Protection Regulation. So this was announced by the European Union in April of 2016 and came into force a couple of years later. A lot of firms weren't ready for it. So Pinterest's Instapaper was taken away from the EU for a period of time. UnrollMe was removed from the EU and still isn't available. Stardust not only withdrew the product, but also deleted all EU residents' records. So there were some quite high-profile examples of companies that weren't ready. And the reason for that, I think, is that it's a very complex piece of legislation with the intention of giving you basically the right to understand how your data is being used. We will need case law, really, to understand how well it works in practice. But I think it's one of those things where there is definitely a move amongst governments all over the Western world to tackle the business of consumer data and privacy. So in California, the Consumer Privacy Act was signed into law in, I believe it was June of this year. The state of Vermont followed quite closely behind with another similar bill. And I think we're going to see a lot of this. And I think this is something we're going to see more and more of. Because if you think about it, we were just talking about self-driving cars. If you think the data that you can collect from, I don't know, your social media records or whatever is a problem, imagine what the data we could collect from self-driving cars.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. Ford CEO Jim Hackett recently hinted in an article that I read about some of the analytics that they're gathering, not just in the financing, which, by the way, $1 out of every $3 in profit is coming, not from car and truck sales, but from financing with Ford. But also with the like driving characteristics of driver. He said something like 100 million people were sitting on top of Ford blue oval vehicles, and that there's a huge case for monetizing those insights. So add that to just self-driving cars, it's amazing the kind of insight that we could potentially get in our habits.
I think we're at the cusp of an industry of seeing a large quantity of legislation coming our way. And in some ways, because we've been slow to put our own house in order, I think to a great extent with the sort of ethical implications of what we do, it's probably not a bad thing that regulators are starting to rattle cages and say, you know, you really do need to look at this. Something else that we've seen on InfoQ and again also at QCon was a real interest in the sort of ethical implications of technology this year. And I think with, you know, Uber getting into a certain amount of regulatory trouble, companies like Facebook possibly, probably actually being co-opted by foreign governments for, you know, nefarious purposes of one kind or another. I think those sorts of stories have an impact, you know, whether it's the Brexit stuff that's happening in the UK or the general sort of polarizing of the political debate and the argument that things like Facebook at least contribute to that. We shouldn't overstate their role, but they certainly have an effect. And I think that sort of plays into this whole mind. I guess the broader point is because software is becoming more and more ubiquitous in more and more people's lives, the impacts that you have if you're working on software just become more profound. You know, if one person throws a bit of litter out of a car window, it doesn't really matter. But if everybody does it, then before very long, the whole world is covered in rubbish. And it's the scale that I think is becoming interesting if you're working on software now. In March at QCon London, we had our ethics track. And I think that was probably the first major tech conference, certainly the first one I know of that had an ethics track, right?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware of, that's true. I think Ann Curry actually spun up a follow-on conference on ethics after it, but that was following QCon London.
And I think that sort of all plays into that whole area. And I, as I say, I think as an industry, it's something that we really need to be thinking about much more. The sort of implications of the stuff that we build can be quite profound. And I think that's quite exciting, but I also think it's quite frightening. It's one of those great power and great responsibility things.
So there was some news recently about Red Hat. I know you wanted to talk a bit about it.
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. So essentially, IBM have acquired or are acquiring Red Hat. IBM and Red Hat, amongst other things, are two of the largest contributors to the Java platform, other than Oracle. So I think one thing with this is it seems likely that IBM will reduce the total number of people dedicated to supporting Java, you would think. I'm not sure that that's necessarily hugely important, but I do think it's quite interesting. I also think it's interesting just in the general context of public cloud, because I think it's something that we can probably expect to see a bit more of in the next 2 or 3 years, that mergers and acquisitions within the cloud space are quite likely to happen. I wouldn't be that surprised if Oracle were to gobble somebody up, or alternatively, they might exit the cloud, the sort of public cloud business altogether. I have the sense, at least anecdotally, that their cloud offering isn't gaining that much traction in the market. And we have had some other companies exit. So Verizon, AT&T, Cisco, and the former Hewlett-Packard, for instance, have all exited the market. I could be really contentious at this point and say I think it's quite interesting to see what Google does. Because, I mean, obviously, Google is one of the big players in the cloud space, but they're quite a long way behind AWS, and they seem to me to be quite a long way behind Azure now as well. And I just wonder, how much longer they will keep going. My guess is that they will always have a bit of a space, a bit of a niche with machine learning type stuff because of TensorFlow and so forth. But I think it's quite interesting just to, you know, I mean, Google almost sort of invented the whole idea of cloud compute as a thing. And yet AWS seemed to me to be a very, very long way ahead, which I just struck me as being intriguing.
Shall we put a pin in 2018 and look at 2019?
That's
okay. So 2019, what do you see as the major trends going forward into the upcoming year?
One of the things we talked about briefly last year was quantum computing. I mean, it's still some way out, but it is just genuinely really interesting.
Before you go into quantum computing, what is it? I've heard that term bantied around a lot. We did last year, but let's level set. What is quantum computing?
Very, very hard to describe in a small number of words. Actually, we published some articles from Holly Cummings of IBM on this, which are brilliant. So I'll link to those in the show notes, which will be a much better explanation. But basically, quantum computers were purely theoretical 20 years ago. They do now exist. They are being built. They exploit certain aspects of quantum mechanics, in particular superposition, which is to do with spin and the fact that an observed spin is in one of two states until you observe it. The other bit of quantum weirdness is to do with shared properties or entanglement. So you can observe one electron and that tells you the state of the other one. And that's been observed over long distances, so sort of 1.3 kilometers. The key thing that you need to hang on to really is that what this means is that quantum computers can deal with certain kinds of problems much faster or in some cases more effectively than classical computers can. And in fact, we had a formal proof of that this year. So a bunch of researchers from IBM and the University of Waterloo in Canada and the Technical University of Munich in Germany combined published a paper which essentially proved that quantum computers could solve certain problems faster than classical computers. So that's kind of why it's interesting. It's particularly, you tend to hear it talked a lot about in the context of cryptography because we rely on asymmetric keys and in theory quantum computers can break a whole lot of asymmetric keys and we'll need new ways of securing stuff, and that's kind of interesting. But there are a whole load of categories of problems, like certain areas of financial risk management would be one example that you might think of, or logistics in vehicle work, or some of the stuff, research that's going on in the medical field, where you basically just need tremendous amounts of compute power, and quantum computing offers you some of those things. And there have been a few things kicking around. So obviously IBM has their Q machines, they call them, which you can actually access via IBM's cloud, which is quite interesting. So you can actually go and run real experiments on real quantum computers and see how this works. Google launched a Python open source library called CIRQ, I think that's how you pronounce it, C-I-R-Q, which again is about playing with quantum computing. Microsoft is doing some stuff with Q-Sharp as well. So you've got all of these companies like Microsoft and Google and IBM and Intel and this company called D-Wave and some others, all of whom are exploring this space.
Are these all new languages that are going to be targeting these quantum processors? Or is it, like you mentioned, Python was one of the libraries?
Great question. There are. So IBM has a Python library and Google has a Python library. And Python is one of those languages that seems to be getting used for a lot of these things. Microsoft has done its own kind of specific language for Q-Sharp. Again, I don't entirely know where that will go. I suspect in the end, we'll need new languages to describe some of the things that we're trying to describe. But Python isn't a bad place to start. It's a relatively easy language for people to get hold of. It's obviously gaining a lot of traction, partly because it's quite heavily used by sort of data science and the whole machine learning space. And so, yeah, there are plenty of open source libraries. As I say, IBM has one, Google has one, specifically around running quantum experiments effectively with a Python library. And it's kind of amazing to me that you can go and, you know, download a library from GitHub, sign up to IBM's cloud and run experiments on actual quantum computers running in an actual data center somewhere. It's sort of, you know, like from my house. That kind of blows my mind. I think it's genuinely exciting. When my dad worked at IBM in like the 1970s and 80s, and at that point, everyone was talking about something called the Josephson Junction, which I don't know if anyone remembers the Josephson Junction now, but basically you had to cool it to absolute zero and then it was really fast. And the problem with that was, you know, when it broke, you had to find an engineer who was willing to work in absolute zero to fix it. I'm being flip, but you get the point. You know, valves of liquid nitrogen, difficult thing to manage. Of course, with cloud and ubiquitous connectivity, suddenly you don't necessarily need, if you're, I don't know, Morgan Stanley or someone, you don't need to buy these machines and learn how to run them because IBM can do that for you. And you can just use IBM's cloud to access them or Google's cloud or whoever it is. And so I think that combination of cloud and ubiquitous connectivity is just really interesting in terms of what that means for the quantum space in general, amongst many other things, but quantum is the one pinging around for me at the moment. What about you? What are the sort of forward-looking things you're looking at? I know you've been thinking a lot around machine learning, so anything in that area maybe?
Yeah, so machine learning, but what's old is new might be a good way of phrasing a few things. So if you remember back, I guess it was 2011 when I first heard about it, maybe, but 2016 in particular, Netflix talked a bit about their Open Connect, which were these boxes. They worked with ISPs to actually stage these boxes. And most of the content that was actually being served to clients all around the world was via the CDN. And it basically, this Open Connect box that they worked with allowed Netflix to be able to, like 2016, when they did the Netflix Everywhere deployment, where they were able to deploy content to like 190 countries simultaneously. It was basically by leveraging these CDNs and being able to deploy content and having it staged all around the world in these particular devices. So where I kind of see things moving is pushing more and more logic out to the edge and actually taking things off of some of the cloud resources. And it's interesting, some of the stuff that's happening in those spaces, particularly within the space of ML and AI. Cloudera, one of our committee members for QCon AI, which will be coming up in April 15th of next year, is Mike Lee Williams. He's at Fast Forward Labs, which was purchased by Cloudera last year, I believe. I should have mentioned that as one of the big trends for 2018. But they just released a report that I haven't had the honor to read yet, but I've read a bit about kind of a synopsis, and they were talking about federated machine learning. And I think it kind of ties into a little bit of the privacy things with GDPR, along with edge and along with machine learning. What federated machine learning is it allows you to use devices like your phone or other IoT possible devices to be able to run machine learning data on a training set that is unique to that particular device, and then upload the actual model that has been tuned on that training set to a central server, and then be able to aggregate those things together.
Okay, so what does that mean? What are the benefits?
It means taking some of the processing power off of these centralized servers and pushing them down to edge devices. It means that some of the privacy implications that may be at play with GDPR, for example, rather than uploading all this personal data to be able to train models, you're able to run them locally on a device and then just push the model, the trained model, up to an aggregated server. I think there's interesting use cases that are happening with edge in machine learning, but in a variety of other areas as well, by being able to use these edge cases. I think Chick-fil-A at QCon New York in June talked a bit about what they're doing with edge computing. So I think that being able to push things down to all these edge devices that we're potentially going to have,
it's compelling.
Statistica had a number that I read, something like 2025, there's going to be 75 billion IoT devices connected to the internet. By leveraging the edge and being able to push machine learning and different functions down to those edge devices and then aggregate them up, I think that's a really compelling forward-looking thing for 2019.
I think that's completely fascinating, actually. And we've known for a while that if you train models on big banks of machines, you can then push those down to small devices to kind of run them. But I think doing that the other way is really fascinating. And the most recent Apple devices have a what they call a neural engine as part of the A12 chip, which again is about exactly this thing. It's being able to run stuff locally and then push it up. And again, in Apple's case, it's partly around privacy and so on. And, you know, Google have their equivalents and so on. I do think that's a really interesting area. I also think, I mean, one of the other things that we're seeing with machine learning is just as we're putting the tooling into the hands of more and more developers. I mean, you know, we've been saying for a while on InfoQ and at QCon that we think that this is a tool set that developers are going to need. And as that starts to happen, just the applications that we're finding are really fascinating. So, you know, we know that machine learning is really good at image processing, and we're seeing that applied in things like the medical field. With interpreting radiography scans, for example, is one that I know a certain amount about, or, you know, CT scans, lung scans, those kinds of things, where maybe surgery might be really invasive. And I think it's worth saying that some of the stuff with wearables is really interesting there as well. I mean, it's easy to be blasé about something like the Apple Watch, but, you know, the new Apple Watch has a heart rate monitor that people are wearing on their wrist. And that's, to me, that's quite a thing. You know, that is a device that you can buy that potentially can save your life if you have a heart issue. when you combine that sort of wearable health tech and machine learning, I think those kinds of things are really interesting. And we're really just scratching the surface of what machine learning can do in different spaces, which I think is kind of fun. It would be remiss of us, I guess, not to talk about microservices, given how important that is in architecture in general, which is obviously kind of at the core of what we do. So maybe you could talk a bit about that for us.
Yeah, sure. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when we were talking microservices at QCon, we were talking about how to decompose the monolith. We were talking a bit about, you know, where do we set our bounded context? How do we decompose these things into services? While we're still talking about what is micro in a microservice, I hear a lot more of the conversation being around how to operate microservices. A lot of the conversation is, how do we properly set up north, south, east, west communication between services? How do we properly secure things? How do we handle authorization, authentication? How do we handle observability? How do we deal with these things? So I think when you get to a certain point now with microservices, the discussion is kind of, how do we enable this? So we would be remiss if we didn't mention Kubernetes. Kubernetes certainly seems to kind of won the battle when it comes to orchestration. People are now building on top of Kubernetes as kind of like a given infrastructure piece. I think we're seeing a lot of things with service meshes coming about. Service meshes are kind of removing, if a cloud removed the undifferentiated heavy lifting of building apps on infrastructure, I think service meshes are starting to remove some of the undifferentiated heavy lifting in producing and writing applications. So it does dynamic routing, and it gives you resilience that you were using libraries like Hystrix maybe in the past to be able to do circuit breaking. And it gives you kind of that best-in-class observability experience and things like that. So there's definitely some interesting things that are happening out there. Some of the names that we hear a lot about in that particular space are Envoy, HashiCorp's Consul Connect just recently moved into kind of full force into the service mesh space. We've seen Voyant with what was originally Conduit became Linkerd2 again. Istio is definitely making a lot of noise. One interesting one in the space is Cilium. So Cilium leverages eBPF, the Extended Berkeley Packet Filter Language, that's being used to do much deeper work inside the kernel, inside kernel space, rather than working in user space with service meshes. There's this great quote that I've seen Jesse Frizzell has used before that says, stop using IP tables for your firewalls. It's like using duct tape to fix a leak. You're just going to have to keep layering it on. So eBPF is like a language, lets you do some like lower level packet filtering and be able to do service mesh level things in the kernel. So it does things like, if I know you're going to make a kind of east-west call between two particular services, rather than sending that out over TCP, if I know that it's on the same machine, all I got to do is open up a socket. So using something like Cilium and eBPF, you can actually do that under the cover. So very cool stuff in that, I think, with the service mesh space.
Worth saying as well, we're seeing some definite pushback against microservices.
Microservices are to solve a specific problem. And that problem is like velocity of developers stepping on each other. If you're deploying many, many times a day and you're having these issues about getting code out there, you're building a pipeline. If you're not running into those kind of issues, microservices may not be the answer to you. Monolith is perfectly fine for certain sets. So some of the other counter side, I guess, to microservices that we're hearing a bit about are people saying, like, microservices wasn't right for us and we shouldn't have gone to microservices. I think that's super interesting. At our heart is a developers, and at our heart is a language, right? So what about languages to see going forward for 2019? What trends are you seeing? What do you think about the language of choice for 2019?
Interesting question. So the first thing to say, I think, is Java isn't going anywhere, obviously, and C# in the .NET space isn't going anywhere either. I think both of those languages are, you know, there's still a tremendous amount of interest on InfoQ for them, and I think that will continue to be the case. In terms of the other languages that we're interested in or seeing interest in, Go is one. We ran a piece recently about Go at The Economist, which was sort of Go and microservices at The Economist. That did extremely well. And in general, we see a lot of interest in Go. We also see quite a lot of interest in Rust. I think if you're doing, you know, kind of anything that's a bit performance sensitive and maybe you don't want to deal with some of the horror that is C++, then Rust is a pretty good alternative to that. And then other languages, I'm personally very interested in Swift. My 10-year-old, who is a big fan of the iPad, wanted to learn Swift, and so I've been learning it with him, and I just really like it as a language, it turns out. I think it's a really nice language. And Kotlin as well on the JVM space, which I guess is kind of similar because it's another Swift-like language that's found its niche for doing mobile development. And that's the other one. I mean, I guess the other language we should mention is Python, because that has been growing really rapidly. And that's fascinating to me. I mean, Python is obviously not a new language. It's been around since about, well, I think Python 1.4 shipped in 1996. So it's, you know, Java kind of age. And it's sort of been bubbling around with a certain amount of usage, and then suddenly it's taken off. And really and truly, I think that's driven by data science almost entirely. I mean, not absolutely entirely, but data science is a huge reason why we've suddenly got this surge in interest in Python as a language.
So one of the things that I know you've got an interest in particular is augmented reality and virtual reality. What's happening moving forward? What's coming up in 2019 with AR and VR?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I just think that area is really fascinating. I mean, the main problem with AR in particular is we obviously don't have the form factor yet. I think we know what it looks like. I think it's likely to be glasses, as in eyeglasses, but I don't think anyone is quite ready with the tech. Funnily enough, we mentioned Apple earlier, and I don't think Apple gets enough credit for how good they've got at building really small computers. You know, if you think of AirPods or the Apple Pencil or those kinds of things, they're sort of discrete computing devices that we don't really think of as computers at all because they just work. And obviously that plays naturally into that whole idea of if you're going to build an AR glasses type device, it needs to be very small and very discrete. There's also the whole issue around privacy. So it loops back a little bit into that conversation. And, you know, I think Google Glass demonstrated to some extent that you really have to have a strong privacy story if this stuff is going to work for you. I think we know where that's going. I don't think we're there yet, but I just think it's a really interesting area. And I think in more general terms, there's so much happening around what we used to call, maybe we still do, human-computer interaction or interface with voice, with AR, with some of the stuff around neural interfaces. So we had Adam, who is head of R&D for a company called Control Labs at KubeCon San Francisco, and I went to his talk, and it just totally blew my mind. So they have a wrist device that picks up nerve control signals. So basically the activity that's happening in your nerves. And they had some demos of, you know, playing Asteroids on an iPhone with a neural interface that's basically reading nerve signals. The reason I think that's so interesting is because in the same way that touch opened up computers to a whole bunch of people that couldn't really use a computer before, so this kind of does the same thing, right? If you're, I don't know, arthritic or something and you don't have a lot of movement, then typing isn't really going to work for you. Touch isn't really going to work that well either. But something that you can control essentially without physically needing to move much maybe will. I'm a bit of a musician in my spare time, and I kept thinking about, oh, all the things I could do with sort of music control with that kind of thing could be really interesting. So I think that's really incredible. And of course, the other thing is all of us who use computers pretty much at some point will have had to adapt our keyboard or our mouse or our working practices in some way because we're starting to get some kind of repetitive strain injury. So it's not just, yeah, it's great for people with arthritis or whatever. It's great for all of us if there is some other way that we can control these machines that doesn't put so much physical strain on the body. So ergonomically, I think that's just genuinely really interesting. And I think that whole space is a long way out, but it just strikes me as being really, really fascinating. I feel like in the same way that we had the touch paradigm shift, I think there is another paradigm shift coming, maybe not for another 3 or 4 or 5 years, but I think when it happens, it will be quite profound.
Indeed. Well, I think it's a great place to stop. As always, Charles, I enjoyed the chat.
Thank you very much once again for having me. It's an absolute pleasure. I always enjoy doing this.
Thank you for allowing us into your commutes, gym, and office space this year. This is our last podcast for 2018. We hope you'll join us in the new year for 2019. We have podcasts already scheduled with Grady Boot, Susan Kaiser, Third Love's Megan Cartwright, and many more. As we fast approach the end of 2018, the pace of innovation in machine learning and AI only seems to be increasing, as you could tell from our conversation on this podcast. If you agree and are looking for ways to adopt machine learning into how you, as a software engineer, can apply it and make more sense of the information available to you, check out KubeCon AI, located in San Francisco, on April 16th and 17th. QCon AI is a software conference about using machine learning in your day-to-day job. This is an applied machine learning conference for you. We have people like Sid Anand, chief architect at PayPal, Mike Lee Williams, who I mentioned in the podcast from Cloudera's Fast Forward Labs, and others like Halle Haidar, who led the application of deep learning at Airbnb Search, all confirmed. We're adding more speakers every day as we individually curate the conference. If you're looking for lessons of how people are applying machine learning in their shops, this is the conference focused on software engineering for you. Hope you can check us out. Thanks again for joining us on the InfoQ podcast, and we can't wait for another year on the show.